Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. Or, if you're listening on the Apple Podcasts app, you can subscribe within the app in just a few clicks. We live in a world in which we tiptoe along a thin line between free will and selfishness, between self-determination and narcissism, between empathy and righteousness. Underpinning everything are these crucial questions. Who am I as an individual? And who am I as a member of a group and society? When did we begin to be as selfish as we are today? At what point did we expect to have the right to determine our own lives? When did we think it was our right to take what we wanted? Where did this us, you, me, or our collective behaviour all come from? And when did we first ask the question, how can I be free? So, Tom Holland, these are questions that I imagine you ask yourself all the time.
Every day, I leap out of bed asking those questions.
They're the questions posed in a preface to a wonderful new book, which we'll come to in just a second. But people often say, don't they, that we live in an age of unparalleled narcissism. And people often like to trace this back to the ideals of philosophers and writers and people who argued about the self and the individual and the kind of romantic ideal of the poet in his garret or staring out over a mountain. I mean, this is very much, not only is it your kind of territory, because you love Lord Byron, who you believe to have been a vampire, but also,
Tom, I mean, that's very much doing what you want, isn't it?
You are very much this sort of person, aren't you? I see you as a rugged individual staring out over great mountain ranges, contemplating
the... That is so kind.
I mean this pejoratively.
So that's poor behaviour by your reckoning.
Well, I'm Samuel Johnson kicking a stone.
Famously,
he kicked a stone and refuted Bishop Berkeley's theory of immaterialism.
So you mentioned Byron, but of course, actually, I mean, this is very German behaviour.
It is German.
Because the idea of romanticism, the very word romantic in the way that we use it today, originates with a group of German philosophers in the university town of Jena, basically in the 1790s. And it's the argument of my dear friend, Andrea Wolf, who, award-winning historian, and despite being German, writes brilliant, brilliant English.
Despite being German. Tom, what an introduction.
And her latest book is Magnificent Rebels, The First Romantics and the Invention of the Self. And Andrea, when you told me about this, must have been 3-4 years ago, that you were planning to write a book about a bunch of philosophers in the university town of Jena, I thought that was a brave choice. Because Dominic, as a kind of John Bull figure, what is your attitude towards German idealist philosophers? Do you read them regularly? Are you a favorite of them? Do you curl up with Schelling of an evening?
Yeah. I mean, when I'm on the train on the way to Molyneux on a Saturday, Tom, I've often got a volume of Fichte with me. reading a bit of Hegel. Absolutely. No, I mean, I think what is absolutely fascinating, Tom, is that this is a world so unknown to English-speaking readers. So in other words, we're in 18th century Germany. So Germany has not been unified yet. We are, as you say, in the era of the French Revolution. And we are talking about one of the, you know, the most advanced, most sort of civilized, most enlightened, as it were, parts of Europe. And all these people who, for many years, actually, in Britain, were seen as absolute paragons and models.
Well, and direct influences on the Romantic movement here.
Yeah, and have since disappeared, haven't they? I think partly because of the World Wars, Tom. They've sort of been airbrushed out. But anyway, tell me about Coleridge.
Well, so Coleridge goes to study there and basically plagiarizes vast chunks of philosophy from Schelling in particular, this philosopher. And that has a huge influence on English Romanticism. So the English Romantics, the French Romantics, all American Romantics, all absolutely in debt to this. And Andrea, you, in your introduction, you say, I mean, you express the significance of this decade, the 1790s in Jena, in very, very kind of vaunting terms, a mere blink in time, yet one of the most important decades for the shaping of the modern mind. And it has to be said that you conclusively, I think, make that case. And not only do you make that case, but you make it in an incredibly entertaining style, because although, you know, the philosophy is incredibly important, as you demonstrate. I mean, they're such a bunch. They're endlessly marrying with each other, falling out of each other's beds, having spats. I mean, you've written it almost as a kind of soap opera, verging at points into a sitcom.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, if you write about philosophy, you need to kind of lighten it up a little bit. And I also think the problem is we see philosophy or philosophers through their works, but obviously they were people. And their philosophy was a philosophy of the self. So they kind of used their own lives as a platform to try this all out. So they became quite egotistical also. So it's a book about big, big ideas about the beginning of the modern self, but it is also a soap opera with lots of sex and rock and roll and fun, and you know, and because we have thousands and thousands of letters, and these are all poets, so they write really well and really gossipy. So because we have these letters, you can enter the rooms with them, you can enter the bedroom with them. I mean, one of them wrote an erotic autobiographical novel where he basically invites the readers to watch him and his lover make love in quite explicit erotic details. So they're philosophers, but they're also very flawed human beings.
Well, you quote Novalis, who is the kind of the prototype of the doomed romantic poet, great poet who dies young, age of 29, I think. So the prototype for Keats and Shelley and all that kind of thing. And you quote from his diary, in which he is endlessly recording his sexual moods and his wanking and all kinds of stuff, which he frames as lewdness raged from morning into the afternoon. So
I know, but then if you go on, there's one where the lewd fantasy in the morning leads to an explosion in the afternoon.
Oh my word!
Yes. So this is very much a collection of people who are not just doing philosophy, I think.
So let's put them,
Andrea,
in place and in time. So we are at the end of the 18th century, and we are in a place called Jena. There was a Battle of Jena, which we might come to later. But first of all, so where is Jena and why should we be interested in it?
So maybe I should start with Germany, just to explain a little bit where Jena is, because Jena is in Germany. So as you said in your introduction, Germany at the end of the 18th century is not a unified nation. It's a patchwork of 1,500 states, ranging from tiny principalities to big, you know, mighty states like Prussia and Austria. And Jena is in the Duchy of Saxe-Weimar, which is in the middle of it. But the unintended advantage of this fragmentation is that censorship is basically very difficult to enforce in these little states because every state has a different set of rules. So very unlike century-ruled countries like England or France. And France, England, Spain have also big, you know, they're big global monarchies, powerful monarchies with a global reach through their colonies. And in Germany, everything is inward looking and splintered. So the German imagination really is fed by words and by books. And Germans are fanatical readers. So the literacy rates in Germany are much higher than elsewhere. So Saxony and Prussia actually lead the world at the end of the 18th century. There are more universities.
I was really startled to read in your, and a little bit embarrassed on behalf of England, I'm afraid to say, that the German book trade in was 4 to 5 times larger than that in England, which isn't at all the impression that one would get from, you know, reading about Grub Street in London or something.
Yeah, and everybody read in Germany. I mean, you cannot underestimate how many people read in Germany. So, and you have 50 universities compared to 2 universities in England. So ideas and arguments traveled quite easily through the German states. But then the question is, why Jena? So Jena is this small town, 4,500 inhabitants. It's a university town. It's tiny, so it takes like less than 10 minutes to cross. It's headed by a pretty enlightened ruler who encourages a certain degree of openness and frankness. But the real reason why there's more freedom in Jena and why it attracts more liberally minded people than anywhere else in Germany is the governance of the university, through which once belonged to Saxony, but through complicated inheritance laws, basically nominally kind of controlled by 4 different Saxon dukes, no one is in charge. So what happens is every writer, every thinker who has, you know, problems with the authorities in their hometowns ends up in Jena. So it becomes this very transient place of very revolutionary minds. And I mean, one great example was that it's so transient that you have a staggering amount of 25%, a quarter of all children born in Jena at the time of the Jena set are born out of wedlock. So there's a lot of sex going on there.
Right, right. And it's a very kind of small, intimate place, isn't it?
Yes.
And you say again and again throughout the book that it's a place that's too small for gossip. So essentially, when people start sleeping with one another or bitching about them behind their backs, it always gets back to them. And so it's ideally suited to the swirl and drama of soap opera.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have, and I think because it's so small, I mean, people walk from, you know, say from their house to the library and they cross the market town and they will meet everybody there. So there's no way you can hide that you're sleeping with someone. And then, I mean, the thing is actually they don't want to hide it. So there are quite a lot of open marriages. So you have, for example, Wilhelm von Humboldt and his wife, who her lover lives with the Humboldts in their house and goes very openly to all their kind of social activities. Or the Schlegel, Caroline Schlegel and August Wilhelm Schlegel, they have an open marriage. She's quite a character. We can talk about her later. So it's very open and no one really seems to mind. And I think also we sometimes forget it's the Victorians who made it all so kind of rigid. The 18th century was quite open-minded about stuff like that.
So let's talk about the big figure. So the big figure who is the sort of godfather, if you like. So he's from a slightly older generation. He is the one German writer, I would guess, that most of the listeners to this podcast will have heard of, that can be guaranteed to have heard of, even if you haven't read his stuff, and that is Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. So Goethe, whose book The Sorrows of Young Werther had been the great kind of hit, I guess, of the, 1770s?
Yes.
And he doesn't live in Jena, but he comes and visits, and he is the sort of, he's the big man, isn't he?
Yes. So Goethe is the literary superstar in Germany. I mean, he was catapulted to international fame through his novel, The Sorrows of Young Werther, which is a novel about a lovelorn man who commits suicide and who, talking about Byron, there's Byron later jokes to Goethe that Werther encouraged a kind of wave of suicides. And Byron said to Goethe that Werther has killed more young men than Napoleon. So, young men would run around in their Werther costume, in a Werther uniform. So Goethe writes this as a young man. And then in the 1790s, when the Jena set kind of happens, he's older, he's in his mid-40s.
And fatter.
Yeah, he has a very bulging belly, which he buttons in with like stripy and flowery waistcoats.
So not very young Werther.
He reminds me of Bilbo Baggins, oddly, Tom.
Yes, the bulging belly.
He's a great
belly.
Fan of coloured waistcoats. Anyway, that's a ludicrous excursion. Sorry, Andrea.
No worries. So by the time the Jena set arrives, he's very much part of the government of the small duchy of Saxe-Weimar. He's the privy councillor.
So that's where the Von comes from. So he's been raised to the aristocracy.
Exactly, exactly. And he's in charge of the mines and the theatre. So he's very much part of the establishment. And but he's also failed to produce anything remarkable for quite a few years. He's very depressed about the political situation, about the French wars, and he focuses on scientific experiments. He's really into botany and comparative anatomy. So he dissects like frogs and caterpillars and everything. So he's feeling not great in the mid 1790s. And then in 1794, he bumps, after a botanical lecture, he bumps into Jena's most famous inhabitant, Friedrich Schiller, who is Germany's most famous playwright. He became famous through his revolutionary play, The Robbers. So they start talking with each other, and it becomes really the most extraordinary literary friendship in Germany. These two are very, very different. So Schiller, for example, is this tall, gaunt, perpetually ill man who can only write when he has a drawer full of rotten apples in his desk.
Yeah. I mean, that is such odd behavior. Yeah.
It is, isn't it? He keeps very erratic hours, work hours, because he is an insomniac, he's ill, and so he's this very tense person, and Goethe is this kind of rosy cheek, kind of, you know, rotund.
Bilbo Baggins.
Yeah. Tom, did you not read this section, finding it uncanny? The tall, gaunt, hypochondriac Schiller.
Tall, thin, almost gaunt, with reddish long hair and pale, blotchy skin. His face was dominated by a large nose and protruding cheekbones. He looked as ill as he felt.
And he's always wittering on about cricket. He can't sleep in the middle of the night because worried where the words for his next book are going to come. And then Goethe, in many ways the greater man, Goethe, who is
the man who's sold out, who's taken
sort of a stouter figure, admittedly, and shorter. But I mean, did you not find that uncanny?
Very weird. Parking Dominic's ludicrous comparison on one side, Schiller also has behaved quite badly, hasn't he, romantically? Because while he's courting his wife, he's also courting her sister. So
very Byronic behavior, Tom.
Very Byronic.
Just a little bit, but then they have a quite conventional marriage, actually. When he finally decides who of the sisters he's getting married to, but so they're very, very different. So one is like a, you know, Goethe describes himself as a hard-headed realist and
yes,
who likes his experiments and his observations.
Loves his science, Dominic.
Well, okay, I don't like science.
And then you have Schiller, who describes himself as an idealist, who's someone who believes that ideas and the mind constitute reality, not matter. So those two men come together and they begin to work together. So they edit each other's work, they encourage each other, and they both enter one of their most productive phases in their lives, and they both of them produced some of their greatest work at this time. So I've kind of cast them, because they're older, I've cast them as the almost like a frame to the story, because then the younger generation, the kind of hot-headed, crazy younger generation arrives. And amazingly, Goethe is absolutely invigorated by their kind of radical and mad ideas. And they, in turn, just put him on a pedestal. He becomes like their demigod. So like their kind of stern and benevolent godfather. So whenever they're in trouble, he tries to mediate. So they fall out eventually with Schiller. And he again and again tries to, you know, keep everybody happy, basically.
Yeah.
So there's this sense of youth arriving in Jena, and this kind of old man, you know, 44, not very old in our days, but then old man feels completely rejuvenated and begins, because Weimar is only 15 miles away from Jena, and he begins to spend more and more time in Jena. Sometimes, I mean, weeks and months on end, sometimes he spends more time in Jena than he's actually in Weimar, because he's away from the court, he's away from, you know, his court duty, so he can be free in Jena. It's very, very different to Weimar.
And do you think he feels invigorated, reinvigorated by being surrounded by all these young people having brilliant novel ideas?
Yeah, I think his most famous work is Faust. And he had completely he was stuck. He didn't write, he'd stopped writing it. And then this kind of gang arrives and he feels so kind of alive again, and he unpacks Faust again, and he kind of writes it. And, you know, the Faust we see today is the Faust he wrote, or large chunk he wrote during the time of the Yenisei.
You talk about the arrival of this kind of gang of young guns. Could we look at some of them? So
yeah.
Who would you say is the most significant in terms of kind of lighting the touch paper with this?
It would be Fichte. I'm sorry to say we're going to have to talk about philosopher now.
Well, he's quite a character though, isn't he? So he's Johann Gottlieb Fichte, that's his
name. Johann Gottlieb Fichte, and he was quite a character. So you have to imagine this guy. He's more bull than a racehorse. He's quite kind of sturdily built and muscular. And he gives his lectures in his riding boots with spurs and whip in hand. And he is feared for his volatile temperament.
And does he use the whip? I mean, is he using it as a prop, or is he kind of, you know, people fall asleep, he lashes them, or what's going on?
I have not read anything. So I think it was just like, he would just come in, a prop. Yeah. But there's nothing gentle about Fichte at all. So he thunders, he shouts, he insults, he stomps rather than walks. He eats his snuff tobacco rather than inhaling it. I mean,
that
he's just
is,
like
that
this.
Is another weird, very weird detail.
So he's so popular. So his students call him the Bonaparte of philosophy because he revolutionized the way we think about us. And he's so popular that his auditorium is packed. The students are standing on ladders, looking through the window. I mean, half of the students of Jena come to his lectures because what he does is, so at a time when Europe is held, most of Europe is held in the iron fist of absolutism, Fichte imbues the self with the most thrilling of all powers, with free will and self-determination. So that might not sound so exciting for us because we are so used to kind of seeing the world through the prism of our own self, but it was such a revolutionary idea then. And so he says, basically, there are no God-given truth. You know, everything that we know, the only certainty is that the world is experienced through the self. And he says, the self posits its own being, which means the self basically brings itself into existence. And not only that, through this initial powerful act, it also brings the external world into existence, at least in our mind. So it doesn't bring the world, it doesn't create the world, but it creates our knowledge of the external world. And that changes everything. That is the beginning of the modern self, because what he does is, his ideas, as simple as it is radical, it says that the self is the supreme ruler of the world. So the self, not kings or queens or gods, rule this world. It's us. It's our mind. And that is just, I mean, that's an explosive idea, which is really difficult to understand now, but it was mind-blowing. I mean, everybody, like students from all over Europe came to Jena to study under Fichte.
I mean, there's a kind of unrepentant individualism, absolutely unrepentant individualism to it, isn't there? My will alone shall float audaciously and boldly over the wreckage of the universe. So, I mean, if you were being harsh, is Fichte the kind of father of modern narcissism? Is that too, am I being too Daily Mail about it?
Well, yes and no. So it has been used like this, but it was never, he never intended a narcissistic celebration of the self at all. Quite the opposite. So what Fichte said was that freedom is always closely interwoven with our moral obligations. So for him, it was this idea that, you know, freedom gives us the choice and how to act and behave. It elevates us over our base instincts of greed and hunger and fear. Freedom always comes with its twin, which is moral duty. And there's a great example, you know, very recently in the pandemic about this. So we have, you know, because we have to make this decision, how can I live a meaningful life where I pursue my dreams, which is the, you know, free will, and be morally a good person? So in the pandemic, millions of us gave up their basic rights and freedoms because they believed these draconian rules of not seeing our friends and family. That was for the greater good. But some of us didn't, because they said our personal liberties are more important. And I think it's this balancing act, this tension between the breathtaking possibilities of free will and the pitfalls of selfishness, which is a balancing act we still continue to this day.
So, Andrea, it's the ich philosophy, the I philosophy, the me philosophy. I mean, it's inevitably, I would have thought, going to appeal more to extroverts. If you're being told it's your own individual, you know, it's your own self that creates reality, that I would have thought is a philosophy that would appeal more to someone who, as Victor was stomping around with his riding crop and boots. Would you say that's fair?
I don't agree with that. I think surely aren't you more likely to be, if you're an introvert, Tom, and you spend a lot of time on your own thinking about yourself, aren't you more likely to be drawn to that philosophy, I would have said, than if you're an other-centered person?
Well, so that ties in with another question, which is that this is a time of titanic deeds, particularly in France, and it's the age of Napoleon. Napoleon kind of, in a sense, is the exemplification of the ich philosophy, creating reality through the realization of his own self. But Germany is fragmented. And Jena, as you said, you know, the freedom, in a way, is also the index of its impotence. And isn't there also a sense in which it's important to someone like Fichte and then to the other philosophers who gather around him to make great claims for this philosophy? Because in a sense, they, you know, they're not sailing to Egypt or storming across Europe or doing anything. They are sitting in lecture halls. And in a sense, the kind of the stereotype of the German in the late 18th century is almost the opposite of the one that kind of is given birth to as a result of the Prussians and then the Nazis, that the Germans in the 18th century are dreamers. And in a way, this is an attempt to kind of dignify that dreaming. Couldn't you say that if you were being very, very harsh, very unsympathetic?
If you want to see it like this, I would actually go back to the French Revolution, because what happened in France, the French Revolution is such a massive, pivotal event that it affects almost everybody in Europe. But when the French revolutionaries declare that all men are equal, they promise a social order that is built on the power of ideas and freedom. So, and I think that is the moment when philosophy leaves the, you know, ivory tower of rarefied thought and arrives in the minds of ordinary people. So this is a revolution that proves that ideas are stronger than any weapon or mights of kings and queens. And I think that gives the mind such a great power that I think we tend today, and I think it's the wrong way of seeing romanticism, we think of these kind of like forlorn, dreamy, broody kind of type of people. That's not what the first romantics were about at all. For them, this was a very, very complex, unwieldy and dynamic concept that has nothing to do with the kind of the lone figure standing in a moonlit kind of forest, kind of, you know, looking over the clouds or something like that. This was something where they said romantic poetry is a living organism and it transcended disciplines. And they put poetry in the ancient Greek meaning at its center, which meant productive and creative. So they wanted to romanticize the whole world, and that meant bringing together the arts and the sciences, humankind and nature. So it's something much more complicated. And what they do is they elevate imagination as the highest faculty of the mind. So imagination had been seen, you know, or had been kind of given a subordinate role in philosophy for centuries. It was kind of regarded with suspicion. It kind of like hit the it kind of obscured the truth. It was unreliable. Samuel Johnson called it a licentious faculty. And they came along and said, like, no. Like, imagination is how we understand the world. But that didn't mean that they turned against reason. They just added it. So what they said is, like, we want to poeticize the sciences. Or Friedrich Schlegel said, I want to make Euclid singable. So there's this sense of creating something much bigger. And it's the later romantics who just messed it all up, basically.
Okay. Well, Andrea, you talk about romanticism. I think we should take a break now. And then when we come back, we should look at the man who first coins the word romantic in the sense that we use it today, his wife, his brother, and all kinds of shenanigans. So we will look at that after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com.
then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. We are talking about the origins of Romanticism and specifically the German Romantics for the town of Jena. And before the break, Andrea, Tom was promising that we would get into the origins of the term Romanticism. And it begins, I believe, with a poet and translator, August Wilhelm Schlegel. So would you like to tell us a bit about him?
So it's August Wilhelm Schlegel and Friedrich Schlegel. So they're two brothers. One, August Wilhelm Schlegel, was always perfectly dressed and perfectly groomed, a bit pedantic. And his brother was this kind of like crazy hothead who called himself a dictator critic, which is a literary critic with a pen as sharp as the French guillotines. And they set out to attack the literary establishment. And they did that with a magazine, a literary magazine called the Athenaeum, a magazine which they said they wanted to be of sublime impertinence. So that was like the most important thing. And it is in the pages of the Athenaeum that they first used the term romantic in its new literary meaning. So forget Coleridge and the English romantics. The first time romantic has been used in this way was actually in Germany. So
yeah, we acknowledge that.
They launched Romanticism as an international movement. And they were, so that's their kind of like intellectual intention. And August Wilhelm Schlegel was also a brilliant translator who, together with his wife, translated 16 Shakespeare plays, the first German verse translation, which to this day is the standard edition. And amazingly, his published lectures on Shakespeare, which were very much informed by his discussion with his wife, then resurrected Shakespeare in England, believe it or not.
Thank you, William, Germany.
William Wordsworth said that a German critic taught us correctly, how to think correctly about Shakespeare. So they are actually quite an important bunch of people.
Because that's the joke, isn't it? That the German version is very good and the English translation of it isn't bad as well. That's the...
Well, I have to say, I mean, I live in England and have lived here for almost 30 years. I always read English stuff, but German Shakespeare performances are pretty good. I think I almost prefer them to the okay. English one. Ooh, I'm hanging myself
that's,
out
that's
on the
window. That's absolutely fine. So, Andrea, you mentioned Schlegel's wife, who is the co-translator on this, and she is an extraordinary woman. And in a way, she seems to be the beating heart of the soap opera, the sitcom, however you want to frame it. I mean, she's a remarkable figure, isn't she? So just tell us about her.
So let me introduce her properly with all her names. She's Caroline Michaelis Böhmer Schlegel Schelling. So she carries the name of her father and her three husbands. And she is, as you said, she's at the heart of this story. She was born in 1763. She was the daughter of a very famous German scholar. She was raised on a diet on literature, poetry, and politics. She was beautiful, educated, fiercely independently minded. She married young, was a widow by the age of 24, then hung out with the German revolutionaries, was then imprisoned by the Prussians for being a sympathizer with the French Revolution. And then not only that, in prison, she discovered that she was pregnant after a one-night stand with an 18-year-old French soldier. So quite something at a time when it was scandalous behavior if you were just on your own in the room with a man. Then after her imprisonment, she kind of zigzagged through Germany, was treated as an outcast. And then August Wilhelm Schlegel came along. I mean, men just fell for her. So he was in love with her. He married her, gave her a new name, and with that, a new beginning, and took her to Jena in 1796, where she really became the heart of the Jena set and not the muse. She's not just the muse. She's much, much she's more important.
Participant.
Yeah. So she does the kind of more traditional thing where she creates the physical space for them, where they all meet and work together and party. But she's also a razor sharp critic who dissects poetry and plays and essays with deep, deep knowledge. And her husband and her friends begin to rely on her literary and analytical mind. She is the editor of the Athenaeum. So she takes the role of the editor. She writes reviews under her husband's name. I mean, many, many, many. And she translates together with her husband the 16 Shakespeare plays, which, of course, was never acknowledged. So her name is not on any of these books.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask about that. So what are the possibilities for a highly educated, highly intelligent woman in Jena at the end of the 18th century? Does she have to do it all through sort of, as it were, using her husband as a vehicle? I mean, what do people think of such an articulate, emboldened woman?
So it was difficult. So most women published either anonymously or under the name of their husbands. There were a few who did not, but I think Caroline chose purposefully not to put her name on there because she was really famous in German for being this revolutionary whore. So it would have been not a good, you know, strategy financially to do that. But Schiller, for example, he had another magazine and he published quite a lot of female writers, but all of them anonymously. So most women would not put their name on there. It changes. There are a few who later do this, but it is, I mean, if there is a place in Germany, then it was Jena that you could do that. So Friedrich Schlegel, for example, his lover is the divorced Dorothea Veit. And she's a writer and she writes a novel, but she also publishes it under the name of her husband. It's a very, very common thing to do.
So Friedrich Schlegel, younger brother of August Wilhelm Schlegel. And this is why the sitcom element starts to come in. So inevitably he meets Caroline and he quite fancies her, doesn't he?
Yeah. So he's younger. I mean, she really has a thing for younger men. There's a moment when she has an affair with the 12-year-old younger Friedrich Schelling. I'm sorry that everybody's called Friedrich and then at the end.
Yeah,
it's really
there's
confusing.
A Schlegel, two Schlegels, no, three Schlegels. Are there?
And then there's Friedrich
Schiller and a Schelling.
Schiller and a Schelling.
Yes,
like it's very complicated. So Friedrich Schlegel falls in love with Caroline, but then kind of steps back because his brother had first fallen in love.
Yeah,
with
so it's all these kind of siblings falling in love with, you know, the same person and stuff. This seems to be a running theme.
Well, I would say, I mean, so the Schlegel brothers and Caroline and Dorothea Veit, who's the lover of Friedrich Schlegel, they all live together in one house. And I would really call that the first German commune. I mean, that's where it all started, basically.
Right.
Because they all, you know, they all live together. And Friedrich Schlegel writes these fragments where he says, like, you know, how could anyone have anything against like a marriage à quatre? So it's a very, I mean, I've not found any letters that indicate that they had like a foursome or something like that. But you have August Wilhelm and Caroline being married in their open marriage. And then a few years in, she falls in love with the 12-year-old, 12-year younger Friedrich Schelling.
I was going to say, he's not 12 years old. That would be very precocious.
He was 12 years younger. Well, you know, Novalis fell in love with a 12-year-old.
Well, we'll come to Novalis in a minute.
And then August Wilhelm doesn't really mind because he has lovers also. So it's all, you know, very open and very casual.
Right. So let's just come to Novalis, who is the archetype of the Romantic poet, because he dies young. He's a friend of Friedrich Schlegel. In fact, he dies. Friedrich Schlegel is by his bedside. And he becomes the archetype of the, you know, the beautiful angel, all that kind of stuff. But actually, he's a more conventional figure than any of these kind of philosophers hanging out in their commune, isn't he? Because he's basically running a load of mines.
Yeah, he's the only one who's an aristocrat. So he comes from a privileged background, but the family doesn't have a lot of money. They just have basically their lineage, and so he runs the mines, together with his father, the salt mines. So he is the only one actually who has a proper job, compared to the others. And he studies in Jena and then in Leipzig, where he meets Friedrich Schlegel. They become like best friends. And then, Novalis is pretty obsessed with Fichte's, philosophy of the self.
Yes, because you say that he wanted to make his body disappear and become spirit alone. So, what exactly does he mean by that?
No one really knows. But he wants to basically transcend the kind of boundaries between, you know, the body and the mind.
Or the lewdness.
But what is interesting is, so he falls in love with the 12-year-old Sophie von Kühn, which kind of makes for slightly uncomfortable reading now. And then she dies after some terrible, you know, surgery when she's 15. And Novalis then takes Fichte's philosophy and gives it his very kind of own twist, because he says, well, if the ich, if the self can basically create the external world and can control everything, I'm going to kill myself because I want to be reunited with Sophie, but I'm not going to do it with a gun or a rope. I'm going to do it with sheer willpower. He believes that, you know, if our mind can move our body, surely, you know, our mind should be able to like regrow an amputated arm and kill us. So it's a little bit bonkers, mm-hmm. but it leads him to write, I think, some of the most exquisite poetry that the young romantics have produced, which is Hymns to the Night. I mean, it's a cycle of six poems, and it's just absolutely stunning. And he plays with darkness and with death in a completely new way. So darkness becomes something positive. You know, before, darkness has always been something kind of scary. But I think he uses also his experiences from the mines, because in the mines you go into the bowels of the earth. And so the darkness becomes this metaphor for going into yourself, which, you know, is to this day a metaphor we use for us.
But also it's interesting because he, presumably in the mines, I mean, he's seeing wheels turn and all this kind of stuff, but he has this, this complaint that nature, basically by Enlightenment philosophy, has been reduced to a monotonous machine, turning the eternally creative music of the universe into the monotonous clatter of a gigantic mill wheel. And that is a theme that is so important to the Romantics, isn't it? This rejection of the Enlightenment idea that everything is just cogs and wheels turning.
Exactly. So they basically turn against these kind of mechanical models of the world. So you have, for example, Descartes, who declares all animals to be machines. So then you have an increasing productivity. You have the Enlightenment, you have steam engines, you have scientists who kind of peer through microscopes to understand the minutiae of life. You have them looking into the heavens to understand our place in the universe. You have physicians inoculating against smallpox. So the world becomes this, you know, measurable, repeatable, classifiable kind of machine. And that's what the Romantics turn against. They don't turn against reason, but what they want is they want to poeticize the sciences. They want to stop this, what they say, this mill wheel, which kind of grounds itself to dust, because they believe that the Enlightenment has stripped the reality of the awe and wonder for nature. So what they really believe is that the external world has become something that has to be observed from a so-called objective perspective. And they say, and this is where Friedrich Schelling comes in with his philosophy, they basically say the self and nature is one. It's a unity. Everything is one big living organism. So if we are part of nature, if the system of nature and the system of the mind is the same thing, it means that when we walk through nature, when we, you know, walk through a forest or scramble up a mountain, it's always a journey of self-discovery. So this philosophy of oneness, that becomes the heartbeat of Romanticism. That is at the kind of the nexus of everything. And that is what then becomes so important for the English Romantics and for the American Transcendentalists.
The irony, though, is that, of course, they're talking all the time about unity, but they are incredibly divided among themselves, aren't they? I mean, you call them the Jena set, but I mean, there's nobody they hate more than one another. Or
Well, imagine this. You have a bunch of rebellious young women and men who live together in a small town, and they have declared their self as the supreme ruler of the world. You're kind of bound to end up with inflated egos, self-absorption and fight. And it's exactly what happens. They end up in what Dorothea Veit calls a republic of despots. That's what they become.
Right.
Yeah, and the arguments that they have are not merely arguments on the page, are they? So there's a scene in which students are throwing bricks through Fichte's windows because they despise his ideas so much. And Goethe says, you know, this is a very disagreeable way for Fichte to have the existence of a non-ich proven to him. So these are things that people are actually, I mean, maybe physically fighting is too strong an expression, but they are prepared to, at least not, if not to take up arms, then to take up bricks about.
Yes. So, I mean, in the beginning, they kind of agree, but they're obviously fighting the literary establishment, and the literary establishment hates them. I mean, like, hates them. They write satires about them. They write really, really savage reviews about them. So, but it's almost like they're just fired up by this. They just love it because, and there's a wonderful quote where August Wilhelm Schlegel kind of says, like, they hate us, great. They curse us, even better. They, you know, they want, they call us blasphemers, even more fabulous. So they quite like the fight. But then in the end, they turn against each other.
Yeah. It starts to kind of break up, doesn't it? Because Fichte flounces off. I mean, he basically says, back me or I'm leaving. And they refuse to back him.
It's the beginning of the breakup is really when Friedrich Schlegel very stupidly writes several savage reviews about Schiller's works, including criticizing Schiller's magazine Horen for having too many translations in there. But his brother himself wrote these translations. So Fichte in the end, Schiller in the end just goes like, oh my God, I just can't deal with these guys anymore. And he basically breaks off all contact. And this is really when it starts, because Schiller had originally brought them to Jena.
Right.
So this is, and then you have Schiller who calls Caroline Madame Lucifer, and Wilhelm von Humboldt's wife calls her a snake, and it just goes on and on and on. And then
women tend to be less keen on Caroline than men. Would it be fair to say?
That's definitely fair to say. And I think that was because she was never willing to play the kind of demure domestic housewife. She was always like, I'm going to hang out with a man here.
With
I'm not going to hang out. Yeah.
One of my favorite bits in the whole book was when, and as you say, they're always kind of flouncing out and having bust ups and writing negative reviews of each other in magazines and things. And Schlegel announces that he's leaving one of them because, Dominic, it was simply too embarrassing to write alongside so many inferior contributors.
Oh, my word, Tom.
So there's something perhaps for you to bear in mind.
What, with my podcast co-presenter? Are you
no,
serious?
I was thinking more of your
no.
many media entanglements.
You're thinking about other media outlets.
I am thinking about other media outlets. So,
what about Schelling, when he gets a bad review, suggesting to the editors that the only person who could write a review about his own book is himself?
We all think that, though, don't we? I mean,
So Schiller has broken up with the kind of younger set. Fichte storms off and has to go off to Berlin. And then you mentioned Schelling, and Schelling ends up married to Carolina. So that presumably also isn't, I mean, it's not hugely helpful to the group harmonies, is it?
No. That is one of the other reasons why it kind of all breaks apart. But not so much, not because of August Wilhelm, who's married to Caroline. It's more because of Friedrich Schlegel, who used to be in love with Caroline, then gave her up for his brother. And then she just, you know, flounces off with the next one. So that's the moment when he, I think, gets so pissed off that he just, you know, all guards go down, and he and Dorothea just write so badly about Caroline, especially Dorothea, actually. Dorothea was, you know, she was not very beautiful.
And she's the daughter of Moses Mendelssohn, right?
Yeah, one of the greatest German Enlightenment philosophers. But she feels always a little bit, I think, overshadowed by Caroline, because everybody just adored her. So the moment her lover turns against Caroline, Dorothea just writes an avalanche of horrible letters. I mean, when you read them, you think that, oh my God. And Caroline doesn't know that at the time. She lives together with her, and she's, you know, perfectly nice and friendly to her. So there's a lot of backstabbing going on.
Brilliant
at
stuff.
The end.
And there's one other figure that we haven't mentioned. Again, I guess a household name, and that is Hegel, the philosopher Hegel. So he's not really part of the set, but he arrives towards the end, doesn't he? When I suppose they're in their falling out phase, and when the glory days are slightly past. So do you see Hegel I mean, so in many ways, that I suppose you could say the ancestor of Marx and of so many kind of modern ideas. Do you see Hegel as part of this world as well?
Well, Hegel is basically, he comes in, as you said, quite towards the end. And it's like, he's this, I mean, now he's this kind of towering figure. But then he's very much, so he had studied together with Schelling. And Schelling is the superstar. I mean, Schelling is made the youngest professor at the age of 23 in Jena. And when Hegel arrives, it takes him like 2 or 3 years to make the decision to arrive. He ponders over everything. So as fast and restless as the others are, he's like very slow, kind of plodding along. And by the time he finally decides to come to Jena, the kind of whirlwind is kind of always blown out. But he comes to Jena to be with Schelling because, you know, Schelling is the kind of superstar. And then what happens is as he is in Jena, he moves away bit by bit from Schelling. So Schelling leaves in 1803. And after that, Hegel really begins his own journey. And he turns against, in his philosophy, he really turns against all this kind of craziness and kind of a philosophy which loves art and imagination. And he says like, no.
And he hates nature, doesn't he?
Yeah. He goes to Switzerland and everybody's like in awe of the Alps. And he's like more interested in the technique of Swiss cheese making. but what he says is he basically says, hold on, philosophy is a serious business. So let's strip all that kind of art and imagination out of it again. So he kind of ends it really. And there's this amazing scene, you know, where you sometimes think, you know, facts are just so much better than fiction. You couldn't invent it. So there's the Battle of Jena when Napoleon arrives with his 150,000 French soldiers and they descend onto Jena and they destroy the kind of almighty Prussian army. And on the day, and the day before the battle, you have, Hegel with the manuscript of the phenomenology, I can never get this word out, the phenomenology of spirit. It's his only copy. And he puts it on the stagecoach out of Jena. And then he sees Napoleon on a horse and calls him the world soul. So it's this extraordinary moment, which is really, that's the end of Jena. Because after the battle, Jena is completely destroyed. The students all leave and... But Hegel is there at the very last moment, like handing over his manuscript.
So it's almost like a sort of harbinger of the herald of the 19th century at the end of the 18th, I guess, isn't he? I mean, sort of pointing ahead to the great ideologies that will dominate, you know, the future. It's an amazing moment, actually, because Napoleon himself is a figure like that, isn't he? So Napoleon himself is a sort of Enlightenment figure who is anticipating...
But also a romantic figure.
But it's anticipating the dictators and the monstrous ambitions of the 20th century. And,
but Hegel sees him as, this is basically where this progression from like feudal system to democracies and freedom, he's basically the end of history for Hegel. That when he sees him, because we think, the French are, in Jena and the Germans don't really want this, but there are quite a lot of Germans who want the French to come because they want to be liberated. They want to live in a republic and not in absolutism. So Hegel, although his life is threatened, he wants the French to win.
But Andrea, so the Jena set basically ends with that they all have bust ups. They all run off and marry with one another and end up hating each other. And then Napoleon comes up and basically kind of trashes the whole thing. But one other thing that I picked up from the book is that a lot of these figures end up veering quite sharply to the right. So they tend to become Catholic. They tend to become quite politically reactionary. And do you think that kind of parabola of kind of burning radicalism fading out, veering back into reaction, do you think that is setting a kind of prototype that will be followed through the 19th, 20th century?
I don't know. I think it is something that happens all the time. You know? Like the big revolutionaries often become, dictators and, nationalistic and stuff like that. So I don't know if they're the prototype. I think it's human nature.
Yeah, maybe.
Fear.
Just to sum up, give us a sense of just how significant this is, because we've about half the podcast has been on the philosophy, but the other half, I'm afraid it's entirely my fault, has been all about
You can see where Tom's interests lie, Andrea.
So just for people, listeners who may not be absolutely au fait with idealist philosophy, just give us a sense of how important this is, not just for philosophy, but for the whole sweep of European history.
I think basically they changed our world. It's as simple as that. They put the self at center stage and it has stayed there for the better of the worst forever. And we have, from the moment they put the self at the center, people had to deal with the perils of this kind of newly emboldened ich or self. And it is the same kind of tiptoeing we still have to do today. And I think it has made us who we are. I mean, it starts with the Enlightenment, but this is the moment where this is why we are a selfish society today. Full stop. I think that's as simple as that. It doesn't mean that they intended it to be like this, but I also think that in a way, like right now in this moment where we live today, you know, we have for long thought that we are free to think, to form our opinions, to control our lives. But right now, all of that, this very core of our society is very much under threat, be it through Russia's cyber interference in democratic elections, be it through the, you know, fake tsunami, the tsunami of fake news on social media, or the kind of right-wing populist political movements. Our democracies are hollowed out right now through liars and through despots. So I think right now it's such an important moment to remind ourselves why, you know, when did we become free? Where does this hard-won self-determination came from? So in a way, the Jena set has given us our mind wings, but how we use them, that's entirely up for us. And I'm interested in history. And I mean, you'll probably definitely agree with me. It's not like a dusty old pile of ideas. It's, you know, I'm interested in history because I want to know why we are who we are. So with my Humboldt book, for example, I looked at the relationship between humankind and nature to understand why we're destroying our planet. And with this book, I really wanted to know, now, why are we such a selfish society? Where does this come from? Where did it go wrong? And, but also to remind myself to be selfish in the Jena set meaning is something good. You know, it means that you are trying to make this, you know, to make society a better society. It doesn't mean to be a narcissistic asshole.
Well, you definitely won't have people like that on our show.
Andrea, thanks so much. Magnificent Rebels.
This is my very last sentence on this podcast.
Yeah.
Narcissistic assholes. If you want more about narcissistic assholes, you can read Andrea's book, Magnificent Rebels, The First Romantics and the Invention of the Self. And they're not just narcissistic assholes, are they? They are.
Not at all.
Very much more than that. And it's a fantastically entertaining book. And I completely take back all the reservations that I expressed when you first said that this was what you were writing. It's an absolute triumph. Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.